Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It turns out that one of the battle spaces in that war, because our enemies have figured out it is the soft underbelly of our society and therefore of our nation, is the drug war, as it's been called. We have been suffering immense casualties in this war, by some accounts, more than the loss in total of the Vietnam War is experienced at the hands of drug traffickers and at the cost of lives of Americans annually. To talk about what this war is all about, and whether we are in a stage of essentially surrendering in the war, and the implications of all of that, I am very pleased to say we've arranged for a full hour of conversation with a man who has thought deeply on these subjects, written extensively, and more to the point, been a policy practitioner at the highest levels of the United States government with responsibility for aspects of this drug war. His name is Robert Charles. He's a frequent guest on this program, I'm very happy to say, a former Assistant Secretary of State with responsibility during his time there as the head of the Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs in the Bush administration. He has served elsewhere, including in the Reagan and George H.W. Bush White Houses. He's a professor of law with experience at Harvard University. He is the author of a terrific book, Eagles and Evergreens, and he is a resource on this topic that I'm very pleased to say we're going to be spending a good hour discussing with him. Robert Charles, welcome back. It's so good to have you. Thank you for making yourself available for a deep dive on a very, very important topic.
Well, thank you, Frank, for focusing on this. I think it's important to every American, and sometimes we forget the most important things.
Well, we do, and one of the things that we seem to have substantially forgotten is, what are narcotics, and why are they a controlled substance, and have been for quite some time? Would you just give us sort of drugs 101, a primer on the problem?
Sure. In society, we have criminal laws, which essentially embody a moral code. And those criminal laws, ranging from things that both deter and punish, you know, burglary, murder, rape, we also have substances in society, narcotics, Schedule I narcotics in particular, although there are different schedules, which are viewed as dangerous to the society, and therefore the distribution of them, in particular the distribution, because our criminal code actually focuses on the distributors chiefly, as well as those who produce them. These are criminalized because they're dangerous. We don't allow people to distribute, if you will, walking death to children, and that's what drugs are. These drugs that are on the Schedule I. So, you know, you have a range of drugs, and they have different effects. I used to draw something called the death curve, which is how fast someone can become addicted to these substances, and why it's important for us to educate and treat those who become afflicted, but also to directly and without compromise confront those that are intentionally distributing the death that really comes with these high-potency substances. And, you know, the death curve, I used to put on it several key drugs. There's a very steep curve when it comes to high purity heroin. In the late 1970s, heroin was somewhere between 2 and 10% pure. Today, in every major metropolitan area of the United States, it's higher than 90% pure. What happens with drugs is that you move from quality competition between these drug traffickers, where they're increasing the purities, Well, you start with price competition. They lower price, and at a certain point, they bottom out in their competition by lowering price, and so they give away the high-potency drug, which immediately addicts people.
It's a loss leader.
Yeah, and of course, what has happened in the last 10, 15 years is that the primary drugs that have killed young Americans and even some older Americans who got addicted, on an annual basis, those numbers have climbed, according to the CDC, DEA, all of those that keep various aspects of those annual recordings. And use numbers have gone up, unfortunately, in just about every category. But the primary drugs in the late 1980s were crack, cocaine, a relatively lower level purity marijuana. Methamphetamine was just making its appearance, and of course, heroin. Today, we have a very different situation. Frankly, the United States Congress, the Republicans and Democrats, as well as the Reagan White House and Bush 41 White House, and actually the late Clinton White House under Barry McCaffrey, who was the drug czar, really did get serious about that issue because too many people were dying. And it was affecting everything from productivity and education to crime rates. This crime rate spiked both personal and property crime tied to drugs. So what happened was they got very serious about it, passed a bunch of bills. They authorized or reauthorized the drug czar's office. The respective sequential attorneys general were very serious about it. Ed Meese used to convene under Ronald Reagan, used to convene a quarterly cabinet meeting with all the cabinet present to discuss the issue at that time. And we did turn the volume down markedly. It can absolutely be done. But unfortunately, during the Obama years, they essentially let go of the kite string, and this got wildly out of control. In the early 2000s, we were losing between 10 and 15,000 young people a year to drug abuse, essentially to overdoses. That doesn't even count the drug-related crime, which is often, unfortunately, deadly. And it went from 10 to 15,000 up to last year, 72, 73,000. Dead just from overdoses. And I want to put that in perspective because, you know, there's several facts here that people don't understand. First, Schedule I substances all share a certain, they all initiate certain neuron receptors in the brain that essentially take free will away from somebody. They cause a person to become more chemically addicted, not just psychologically, but chemically addicted to the substance. And by the way, marijuana fits in that category as well. People often talk about alcohol versus marijuana, and it's really not a fair comparison at all. Alcohol is a water-based effector of brain activity, and in 48 hours or even 24, most of that is out of the system. Marijuana infects and affects the brain in ways that penetrate the fat cells of the brain, and there's been some great research done on this, ongoing research at Harvard by people like Dr. Bertha Madras, probably the leading medical expert in the field as it relates to that issue. And 30 days later, the behavior of a person is still potentially affected by the penetration of that drug, a Schedule I drug, of the fat cells.
We're going to have to pause here for just a moment, Robert Charles, but we'll be talking with more about this with Robert Charles, former Assistant Secretary of State for the Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Robert Charles is our guest. We have the privilege of talking with him about a whole host of issues from time to time, and you see him at Fox News and read his writings there at foxnews.com and elsewhere. But we're talking about an issue on which he is deeply knowledgeable, has been personally responsible in the George W. Bush administration as an assistant secretary of state, and that is narcotics, the trafficking of them, the danger that they pose to our society, and what we best be doing about it. And just before the break, Robert was mentioning that one of those narcotics, a Schedule I narcotic at that, is a drug that has now increasingly been described as not only a good-for-you item if you have certain medical conditions, but something that you can indulge in as a personal pastime without material harm to you or, for that matter, to society. And Robert, if you just pick up on that point, we'll get into some of what's happening, but just the proposition that dope, as it's been called, among other things, is really a very benign thing, not in fact a potentially very dangerous narcotic. Walk us through that.
Yeah, it's one of the, I would say, thank you, Frank. I would say it's one of the saddest pieces of disinformation in the public square today, that somehow marijuana and the THC component are either medicine as they're administered by smoking, or that they are somehow harmless. In fact, the only reason to smoke marijuana is to get high. And that is, and there are significant downstream organ damage, et cetera, that can come from that, as well as the change in the chemical. You can look at the NIDA charts, you see the change in the brain, which triggers a higher receptivity to the neuron receptors are the same ones that, for example, become susceptible then of greater susceptibility to opioids. But I want to back up a step on marijuana. You know, there are 400 analgesics out there that are available to people for pain reduction, and most of them do not make people high. They do not basically suspend or change the mental behavior of a person. They reduce the pain level. And in fact, if someone really likes THC as a choice, if that's for some reason that's organic to them, you can get it in the form of Marinol. You can get it in forms that do not create this this high. This has been one great big, I'm hunting for the right word. It's a great big disinformation campaign that has been pushed by people who want to make a lot of money by addicting people to marijuana. And by the way, if you go back 5 years, one of the most fascinating facts is that nationally, the number one drug for which people voluntarily sought treatment was marijuana. And that doesn't mean that heroin doesn't addict more than a million people. It doesn't mean that any one of these drugs isn't worth all of our attention. But, you know, it starts at the most basic level. Parents need to know the facts. And the fact is that marijuana is a Schedule I drug. By the way, there are also very, you know, one of the things that we didn't mention in the last segment is that these drugs are all at a higher potency level today than they were 15, 20 years ago. Marijuana is roughly 25 times as potent today.
Wait a minute, excuse me. You said 25 times, not 25% more. 25 times?
Right. You can get now THC in concentrations up to 99%. In all kinds of, you know, of course, these states that have legalized the smoking. How many medicines, by the way, Frank, in your experience, have you ever smoked? I don't think medicine is a smoke. It does so much collateral damage to smoke something that it doesn't make any sense to make that a medicine. But they are now injecting THC into everything from cookies and brownies to lollipops. And so this is a dangerous, dangerous trend, and it's based on misinformation intended, of course, to ramp up the profits for this new embryonic industry that is essentially a drug addiction industry. I've often said to people, listen, if you're in the public policy space, I don't care whether you're a teacher, you're a mayor, you're a member of Congress. You need to understand this is a binary choice. You either promote drug addiction or you're against drug addiction. And that goes for everything from heroin and fentanyl and the synthetics that are killing people at that high end to the ones that break down the neuron receptors and give them a greater vulnerability to becoming addictive, which include marijuana. Marijuana, of course, is just one of the drugs that breaks down, you know, the process. And people tend to move very rapidly these days from a drug like a high potency marijuana over into cocaine and other synthetics. And, you know, one of the more dangerous drugs out there, even today, despite everything we've done, is methamphetamine. I also want to address this issue of legalization because it's a misnomer that somehow you knock out. One of my graduate degrees is in economics, and it is a complete misnomer that you destroy the black market by legalizing, and that somehow you now bring into the light all these profits. All you're doing is legalizing what is a bona fides crime. We could get rid of all criminal, let's say, rape or murder by legalizing those crimes. That does not change the public safety and health damage to the society. the public health damage to the society and public safety damage to the society by legalizing drugs is actually higher, substantially higher than keeping them illegal. And why is that? Until you will always have a black market for an addictive substance at different addictive potencies until the time when the government gives away in unlimited quantities 100% pure that drug, whatever you name your drug. And the reason for that is that people who are addicted invariably cannot get enough of that drug and can't get it at the high they always are looking for a higher purity in that drug. That's why, by the way, we have so many fentanyl deaths today. Fentanyl is about 50 times more potent than heroin. Carfentanil is even more potent. It's so potent that you can't touch it without actually having an adverse effect. So the problem is that addiction is a devastating, regardless of the drug, it is a devastating distortion of free will. And it's sad. I mean, I have friends who ranging broadly, every demographic is affected by this. You know, I have friends who are Wall Street folks who have their kids confronting this. And, you know, reality is if you don't get the right information out, if you don't speak the truth about the damage created by addiction, the potency of these drugs, then what happens is gradually people normalize it. And, you know, Khrushchev, I think, was one of the first ones to say the United States will face their own comeuppance when drugs overtakes them.
And Robert, let me just interrupt on that point, because I'm not sure whether he was the first to weaponize that insight. What I've heard Mao was perhaps, but whichever, enemies of this country, as I said at the opening, have figured out that if they can hook up our youth and well, countless millions of other Americans to one or the other of these debilitating narcotics, they're not going to be much in the way of a resistance to the ambitions of those hostile powers and perhaps their aggression to them, right?
So you make an excellent point. And one of the points I make, Frank, when people ask me to speak about it, is that every level of security is adversely and significantly affected by not focusing on turning down the drug addiction level and the drug transshipment level into this country. And the president, by the way, is absolutely right about this. The personal security level is affected because you were affected when you walk down the street by drug-related crime. 80% of those in prison are there for having committed, not a possession, not a use crime, but for having committed a crime, property or personal crime tied to drug use. In fact, six times as much crime is committed by people on drugs as by people just trying to get money for drugs. So your personal security is affected. Your family security is affected. Do you know the devastation of a family? And I could spend hours and hours on this. A family that is confronting a family member who is addicted goes through every kind of emotional contortion because this family member that's addicted becomes, in a sense, a slave of the disease. And as a slave of the disease, they lie to the loved ones, they steal from their loved ones, and ultimately their loved ones either have, you know, the strength to try to rescue them and pull them out of this, and ultimately that person has to find the inner strength to pull themselves out of the addiction, or the entire family goes down. And that includes parents and siblings and grandchildren. It's a devastating family security issue. Then you have the state level crime numbers. Then you have the national security level. And frankly, on the international level, the Far East is afflicted by this, and some are, you know, our hemisphere has been afflicted. Here's the good news. The good news, Frank, is that we have managed under Ronald Reagan and George Herbert Walker Bush, and frankly, the end of the Clinton years with Barry McCaffrey, we have managed a solution. The solution always includes five components. You have to be aggressive and truthful in preventing young people in particular from misunderstanding the danger. You have to prevent drug use and say, hey, there are healthy choices. You don't need this. You have to treat those. The second big area, you have to treat those effectively, not with faux cures, but with genuine cures to addiction. And the Hazleton and Betty Ford Clinic and some of the others are very good at this. There's some new technology out in California called MERT, done by the Brain Treatment Center, that's very promising. End of the day, treatment is extremely important. That's number two. Number three, you have to reinforce and fully fund your law enforcement community at the state, at the local, state, and federal level. That means properly funding DEA, of course, at the federal level, and FBI and CBP. But it also means understanding that state-level law enforcement officers confront these traffickers, Dominican, Colombian, Mexican, Far East Asian. They confront these traffickers in their communities in all 50 states every day. They put on a vest, they put on a gun, and they go out to protect you. So you have to absolutely support law enforcement. The fourth piece is you have to secure the border. The border is a centerpiece. It's interdiction. So you interdict on the high seas. That's what the Coast Guard does. And you also interdict in our littoral waters, and you interdict at the border. And the last and fifth area where I worked with 70 different countries under Colin Powell is international source country production reduction. So you want to get at China and say, listen, you got 600 producers of fentanyl. We're going to put a codicil on this trade agreement, and you're going to ramp down this fentanyl transshipment.
Bob, we have to pause. We're at a hard stop. When we come back, I want to again work through that ambitious agenda with you and figure out what are we doing in each of those five areas now, and what more needs to be done. That and more right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Robert Charles is in the house virtually. We are talking with him about matters on which he has considerable knowledge and personal professional experience, notably as the Assistant Secretary of State under Colin Powell and George W. Bush, with responsibility for the Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement. And Robert, you just laid out a five-point plan, and you said it has worked in the past. And I'm interested in exploring with you, are we pursuing it today? And if not, why not? And to what extent is the problem that you've really been laying out for us in these previous two segments a direct product of, well, kind of a failure to learn lessons from the past and apply them to our mutual benefit? So let's start with the whole idea of teaching the young. And often what's said in these kinds of conversations is, well, look at what we do to encourage people to drink alcohol. And alcohol is also a debilitating drug, in effect. It's not a Schedule I narcotic, but it can, you know, destroy your liver, it can destroy your life, it can destroy your family, and so on. And yet that's legal under certain circumstances. By contrast, we have to this point, by and large, said drugs are not legal. But now, as you mentioned earlier, we're saying some are, specifically marijuana and these various products for conveying it. So what message are we teaching our young in this regard at the moment, and how should we tune that up? There's a new book on the subject, Tell Your Children, and I'm interested in, you know, how important this piece of the five-point plan is as you see it.
So I think prevention is in many ways the foundation stone of future health of the country. And you raise a good point, and I'll respond to it directly. You start out in the prevention area, you have to, kids are smart. And so because they're smart, you're best to educate with data. You can also educate with emotion. You can explain what the devastating effects are of addiction and how that affects a family and the disappointment that attaches when someone unfortunately makes bad choices and finds themselves trapped in that deep, dark well of addiction. But prevention is about using the truth to explain to the youth that there are good choices and there are bad choices. Now, marijuana is a Schedule I a narcotic for a reason. And the reason is data specific. It is because it has a very specific effect on the brain. It lasts over time. It changes brain chemistry in a way, and narcotics tend to do that. You can see this on the National Institutes for Drug Abuse slides. If anybody Googles the National Institutes for Drug Abuse and go on and look at the EEG slides, you will see the effect on the brain of marijuana, of meth, of heroin, of cocaine. And what you see is that parts of the brain actually go dark. They literally go dark. Sometimes with treatment, there's recovery of those dark places in the brain, but sometimes there isn't. Meth is one of the most devastating there. It is a fat-soluble narcotic. Alcohol you can have acute use of alcohol with enormous danger. That's why we make certain things illegal. We make drunk driving illegal. Okay, we make behaviors inexcusable just because someone has been affected by alcohol. But alcohol is also water-based, and the data behind what it does to the brain is fundamentally different. I want to go to the heart, though, of this idea of what is prevention and why does it matter. Parents, one of the most shocking numbers is that only about 25% of parents talk to their children about the damaging, devastating effects of drug addiction and of even casual use leading quickly to addiction. And you think about how many times does a parent tell a child when they're young, look left and look right before you cross the street. They spend endless hours educating them about simple things like that. This is a simple thing too, and it needs to be. Interestingly, Black Americans parents talk to their kids more than white American parents do about this. And I find that fascinating because ultimately in some of these communities, you find that they are very sensitive to the impact of what drug addiction and drug-related crime will do to someone. So, you know, we have to be honest about this. And the fact is that when you cross-educate kids, when you tell them that marijuana, for example, is harmless or is tantamount to harmless, you're leading them straight into a brick wall. And in some cases, based on just the Dawn data, that's the hospital room data collected in 20, that's the emergency room data collected in some 20, 21, 22 hospitals nationwide, you find that these kids are, they're listening to this propaganda that says, go out and use this and you won't be addicted. Well, it turns out they do get addicted. That's why in most of the legalizing states today, from Colorado to Oregon, you'll see there are dramatic upticks in numbers of drug driving deaths, drug driving admissions to hospitals. You'll see that the addiction rates are higher. You'll see that the cost to the public treasury in those states is moving toward exponential. And why is that? It's because when you move toward one addictive substance, it breaks down the resistance to using another addictive substance. It's standard. In fact, it's so standard that you don't even, it's not even an opinion question. If you were once a heavy user of marijuana and in 15 years later, you break your leg, you go in, you get OxyContin for a week, the susceptibility of your brain to addiction to that OxyContin is dramatically higher. And so what happens is the addiction levels are a direct function of whether a child in their early brain development years gets exposed to these drugs. And so I say, you know, if you're a responsible parent, teacher, civic leader, do not look away from this. Tack into the wind and say, I understand that there's a lot of propaganda out there pretending or supposing that this is somehow safe. It is not safe. And the data coming out of Harvard and every other study in this area, ranging from NIDA to the FDA, tells you it's not safe. Look, if you want to make THC a regularly available drug for the purpose of analgesic treatment of pain, then run it through the FDA process. And if it comes out the other end, perfect. I'm going to tell you, the FDA does not, never has, never will promote the idea of smoking marijuana as a bona fides legitimate medicine. We don't smoke medicine in America.
Yeah. Robert, we're going to run out of time before we run out of your points. I just want to make sure we move through them quickly. Treatment is obviously something that we are spending a prodigious amount of money on. You know, when you were talking in the last segment about the impact on families, the costs to families of trying to get kids off this stuff or healed as a result of what it does to them is stunning, obviously crippling at the family level, but it's an incredible burden on the society as well, isn't it?
It is. It's extremely costly. It can cost tens of thousands of dollars in the end for some addicts or addicted people, basically people afflicted by the disease of addiction, to get out of that. And so, you know, one of the things I would say is, if a family is caught in this trap, go seek help immediately. Don't pretend it's going to go on away on its own, and try to gird yourself, because when you undertake a serious mission, for example, trying to help a loved one get out of addiction, it's going to take serious effort. It's going to take time. There's going to be heartbreak. But at the end, it's well worth the effort.
And deferring it makes things infinitely worse, obviously, is the corollary.
And you can lose that person. It takes 2 weeks to get addicted to opioids. It can take 10 years to get off them.
I've been told it may even be, in some cases, you know, just hooking up once, the heroin and the levels that you're talking about.
The high-purity heroin that these drug traffickers from Mexico are transshipping, absolutely. It can be a one-time use. And I work with parents in some cases who've lost their kids, who barely use drugs, and that was the end. So I urge people to be conscious of how important this is as a national, as a societal issue. This may be one of the top three issues in the 2020 election, because those who take it seriously, who understand it as a nonpartisan issue, who understand it as the future of America, those are the people we need to be entrusting with the solution. On law enforcement, I can't say enough good about law enforcement. They make our lives possible every day. They deter crime, and in particular drug crime, because drugs are the 80% cause of those in state prison. They are for either drug, basically crimes committed on drugs, as well as major drug trafficking. At the borders, what can we say? The president has said it all. The borders are something that is essential for the protection of every American's public health and safety, and it goes as much to drugs as to anything else. Indeed, I think it's more important from a drug perspective than even from an illegal alien.
Well, let me ask you about this, Robert, because one of the things that's often said in opposition to the president's efforts to secure the border and build the wall is that the vast preponderance of the drugs that are being brought into the United States come through the ports of entry, and all we really need to do is just tighten up on them. What's the implication of having open borders for the flow of that traffic through these ports of entry, as they're called?
So look, most of these high-potency drugs are not made in the United States, Frank. And that goes broadly for methamphetamine, fentanyl, heroin, cocaine. They do not come from within the United States. They come from outside. So what should you do? What you should do is you should tighten up at the ports of entry. You should also understand that the drug traffickers go to weakness. That's what criminals do. They go where there is weakness. And so between the ports of entry is critically important. Getting our postal system secure is critically important. And this president is trying. What boggles my mind is that I worked closely with someone like Elijah Cummings, who is the president Democrat from Maryland, who's the head of the Oversight Committee. Elijah is a good man. He comes from a part of Baltimore that was afflicted by drug transshipments. I know because I worked with him. It boggles my mind that we can't get to bipartisan agreement on all five of those elements, prevention, treatment, support to law enforcement, border security, and source country programs. Surely, in a world in which we care about our kids, no matter what party they're going to grow up to vote in, if we care about our kids, if we care about the future of this nation, people like Elijah Cummings and President Trump should be able to agree at least on trying to save our kids from this scourge.
We have to take a final pause. When we come back, I do want to visit with you a bit about this international source problem. They invariably say, the countries that are the sources, that this is a demand problem. It's not their fault. They're victims of what's happening in our own country. And I want you to walk us through that as well. We'll be right back with more with Robert Charles right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back for the final segment of a very bracing, very troubling, and very important conversation with Robert Charles, who has served our government in a number of capacities, including as an Assistant Secretary of State in the George W. Bush administration. He is the author of Eagles and Evergreens, a terrific book about his native Maine. He is a former naval officer, worked in intelligence matters, worked in the White House under Presidents Reagan and Bush, a man of many parts. But we're tapping into his expertise about narcotics and what they mean for our society. And Robert, when we left off in the last segment, we were talking just a bit about your fifth area of concern and focus of effort on trying to get countries that are sources of these drugs, whether it's China and fentanyl or Colombia and heroin or Afghanistan and the like, to stop supplying it. And I just posed to you the proposition that many in those countries put forward in terms of why this really isn't their problem, it's our problem, is that they say it's a demand issue, not a supply one. So walk us through that too, if you would.
Yeah, so supply and demand are obviously both important in anything. The unusual thing about a narcotic, and the narcotics we're talking about are very high potency narcotics, fentanyl, heroin, cocaine, crack, other synthetics. The interesting part is that narcotics are one of the only substances on the planet that the supply generates its own rising demand, because when someone first experiments with the drug, particularly if it's very high potency, there's a drawback to it. And before long, the price elasticity of demand, which is the idea that there's a bounciness to a change in price for something, a commodity, does not work with narcotics. Once they have become addicted, they will pay any price for that addictive substance. So in this unusual situation, although we should be constantly looking to reduce demand in this country through prevention, treatment, law enforcement, deterrence, border protection, education, at the same time, it is unusually important that you reduce the supply of the commodity. So how do you do that? You do that both by protecting the borders, but in these countries, the supplying countries, you actually can coordinate. I think we have found that, and I did this in my prior job, you can coordinate with these countries to reinforce, for their own benefit, not just ours, wringing the public corruption out of the system. Drugs are the number one accelerant of public corruption. Legalization doesn't do it. Legalization, even in these countries, simply puts the imprimatur of legitimacy on crime. You can't do that. What you have to be able to do is work inside these countries to incentivize them to train their law enforcement community, work on their own prevention programs, work on their own treatment programs. And the United States, believe it or not, is probably the number one country in the world for going around to these countries. We have programs now. My own bureau has programs in 90 of these countries, training law enforcement, helping with treatment, helping with prevention, helping put rule of law back on the face of the map. And why? Because at the end of the day, it is so much easier to teach a man to fish, as the old adage goes, than to keep giving him fish. And if we can put rule of law in place in these places, then what happens in a place like Colombia, where Plan Colombia 15 years ago was extraordinarily successful, is that where the country has the political will to fix itself, and they just need the resources, the training, the equipping to do it, we put them in a much, much better position. The ambassador from Colombia to the United States at the end of what was formerly Plan Colombia and the Andean Counter Drug Initiative, seven countries working together to get drugs down during the George W. Bush administration, at which we did very successfully. They came here to the United States and had a huge event and said, most Americans don't understand that what you did for us in Colombia literally was the biggest foreign policy achievement that the United States has had since World War II. Unfortunately, during the Obama years, they let that go, and we now have a terrible situation. The only silver lining is that there is another president. We don't have President Uribe down there anymore, but we have a president named President Duque, and he is dedicated to the proposition of doing what President Uribe did. And so what do we have to do? We have to remember that source countries, it's better to solve the problem on their soil than it is to have it infect our country and try to solve it here.
Let me just ask you, this is a critical piece of your five-point plan, for sure, and I'm so glad we had a chance to sort of go through this in detail. But let me turn to one other aspect of this that is making me particularly concerned, and that is the money that is now pouring into the marijuana industry in America that is, as you said, hooking people up, putting them in a position that will inevitably lead to a demand for more powerful drugs, and all of the costs, societal and personal and familial and so on, that will flow from that. Talk a little bit about that big business, the cartels' involvement on the one hand, but also American investors, even private individuals getting into the act.
Frank, it is one of the most discouraging aspects, I think, of modern society, that we have become there is a segment of the population, those investing in marijuana, that have become so cynical that they literally are investing in a narcotics addiction industry. This is nothing more or less than an intentional effort to addict people to a substance from which others can make money. This is what the cartels do in Mexico. This is what they have done successfully trying to penetrate, particularly in the last 10 years, just about every county in the United States. And what's happened is we have fallen victim to the rhetoric to the idea that marijuana is somehow not dangerous. And the sad fact is there is not a responsible parent in the United States, nor a responsible sibling, nor a responsible grandparent that would ever promote the idea that their child or sibling or grandchild should go out and use this modern marijuana, either synthetic or organic. It is an addictive narcotic. It intentionally changes the brain chemistry. There's the data on it is now coming back, by the way, Frank, in huge numbers. So the money in this is really driven by, and you can look these people up. I mean, people like George Soros have pushed this idea very hard. The idea is that, hey, here's a big, okay, they've cracked down on tobacco, which was probably 1/100th the problem. They've cracked down on tobacco, but they're opening the door wide to this Schedule I narcotic. Remember, under federal law, marijuana remains, because of its THC content, it remains illegal. These states are truly flying in the face of both medicine, science, and the law.
Yeah, and that's one of the questions I just wanted to ask you, Bobby, because you've obviously worked at the federal level. How can they do this when it remains illegal at the federal level to engage in such businesses?
You know, it's a strange and longer conversation, but I'll make it short. In the law, there is a sub area called conflicts of laws, and that is the areas in which the federal government, for reasons of either the supremacy clause or commerce clause, have actual constitutional authority over a state. So there are things that we have as federal laws that, for the public health and safety of the country, we enforce. Narcotics laws have always been that. What's happening is these state-level folks under the Obama administration, they literally, the federal government stepped away from enforcing the law. People like Holder and Lynch were sworn to enforce federal law, but they didn't. Not on this count. They let these states go. And so what's happening now, and I will say that Attorney General Sessions was very strong on this. I presume Attorney General Barr, if he makes it, will be. The DEA does work to help federal prosecutors prosecute individual cases on marijuana, but there is a conflicts of law question that has to be addressed. And the sad part is that many conservatives say, well, hey, I'm in favor of states' rights. That's where my heart lies. Indeed, people like Ed Meese will tell you that right off the front. I agree with them. But there are individual cases in which, for example, federal terrorism, hijacking laws, and federal narcotics laws, where the federal government, in order to keep all of us safe, has to do this. Why? Because drug traffickers are mobile. Drug traffickers, there's not a Kentucky drug trafficker and a California drug trafficker. They are mobile. They are a national problem. They are endangering children and cities and towns all over the country. And that's why it's a federal issue. I'm not big on federal government. I think a minimalist, limited government is the way to go. But when it comes to protecting our children, I am dead set against the trafficking organizations. And frankly, it doesn't change when the state of Colorado decides it's going to become an official trafficking organization. That doesn't make me happy. That doesn't make me any less resolved to stop the trafficking of the drugs. The sad fact is that in that state, for example, people buy drugs and then they go and use them in adjoining contiguous states, and then they have elevated drug driving deaths in those states.
It's a problem, as you say, in every state, and it will be a problem of growing and epic proportions if this business of getting people hooked up with marijuana isn't corrected. Robert Charles, thank you so much. This is an extraordinarily important topic. We'll speak with the rest of you again, I hope, tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.